Welcome to Hot Media with Bob Mann. Marshall McLuhan gave us the terms hot and cool media. On this podcast, we have a slightly different definition of hot media. We discuss the hottest media controversies and the hottest new content in mass media. If you're interested in the communication field, please join us. Hot Media starts now. Welcome to episode 129 of Hot Media, entitled Revolution 67. Before we begin our discussion with filmmakers Mary Lou and Jerome Bongiorno, I want to ask you to follow me on Twitter, my handle, at BobManMedia, B-O-B-M-A-N-N Media. You can follow me on Instagram, BobMan92. Please come to the website to find out more about the podcast, www.BobManHotMedia.com, and we would love to hear from you, especially now as we discuss more and more controversial issues. And the email address is profman53@gmail.com. Back in 2010, when I first interviewed the documentary filmmakers Mary Lou and Jerome Bongiorno about their film Revolution 67, I thought of it more in terms of a history lesson, something which was a cautionary tale about an America which had come and gone. We had evolved and gotten past it. Obviously, the events of the past few weeks have proven that that is just not true. And so, in an effort to find perspective, especially on a media issues podcast, I decided to call up Mary Lou and Jerome again so that they can talk about their great documentary, which is actually part of a trilogy about the city of Newark, and to ask them what lessons should have been learned from that documentary. I, having grown up in the New York tri-state area, always referred to it as the Newark riots. This was the first time I ever heard of 1967 in Newark in terms of an uprising or a revolution. So, Mary Lou, for the audience members who don't know what Revolution 67 is, please give them some background so that they know what we're talking about.
Yes, of course. So Revolution 67 was the first in our trilogy. We're calling it the Three R's Trilogy on our home city of Newark. And yes, Bob, I'm glad you're bringing up the point of terminology, and because words are very, very important here. We put a lot of thought into that title at the time. Basically, our documentary is an anatomy of a riot. Specifically the riot, but rebellion, notice I'm bringing in that word, revolution that happened in Newark in 1967. And then shortly thereafter, we saw a similar uprising happening in Detroit. So the uprisings then were sparked by an incident of police brutality. And in our documentary, we explored all of the immediate precipitating events that led to this uprising. And then we had to dissect what happened during those 6 days. But most importantly, and here we're going to evoke Dr. Clement Price, the late Clement Price, who really got us to focus on tracing the decades of neglect that led to this revolt. And we learned that the same things that plagued these Rust Belt cities then, happening again today, history repeating itself, not learning lessons, you know, seeing racist policies, how this all led to poverty. And that is the root of all of these problems.
It's a little surprising that we haven't really learned our historical lessons. Were you surprised?
No, I don't think it was surprising in the least. You know, this is something that keeps recurring because the root problem is still there.
When you talk, though, about Revolution 67 and this documentary, let's take a look at Newark in 2020. While there was so much going on in the streets of New York and so many other cities, especially Minneapolis, Newark, New Jersey had some of the most peaceful protests in the entire United States. And Roz Baraka is the mayor. You and Jerome are experts in the history of the city of Newark and some of their social political issues. Can you explain at all why Newark had some of the most peaceful demonstrations without any kind of incident and still had great turnout and great response in terms of people marching, protesting, and speaking, but that there was very little physical conflict?
Well, Newark's been scarred by what happened in 1967, and Everyone in Newark knows that. So Mayor Baraka knows that. His father, Amiri Baraka, is in Revolution 67 and was part of the Newark Rebellion in 1967. The older generation of activists, they certainly know that. And there's a whole new younger generation of activists. And most importantly, law enforcement knows that. So I would like to single out Lawrence Ham because he, as the chairman of POP, which is People's Organization for Progress, he organized last Saturday's march, 1,000. And it's no surprise to us that it was such an important and peaceful protest because Larry's always protesting injustice in Newark. He's always on the street corner. He does this all the time. But he does it peacefully, and it's very, very powerful because he's also advocating for jobs. And for us, for Jerome and I, that's why we featured him in every film in this trilogy.
Jerome, what should we have learned? Mary Lou touched on it, but what should we have learned in depth from 1967, not just in Newark and the subject of your documentary, but also from Watts in 1965 and so many of the other situations that happened around the country? What should we have had in the back of our head as knowledge going into 2020?
I think we should think about the word poverty, because I think the first thing we should learn is that poverty is at the bottom of these issues. And, you know, these riots are not going to stop until the poverty in these cities is reduced. Now, what does that mean? What am I talking about? That means that instead of the government and the police reacting with violence, they need to reach out to poor communities with compassion. And much of that compassion needs to take the form of funding that has to be used to create programs, you know, like they did during the Depression. And these programs should aim for three goals. First, the funding should aim to increase the educational achievement of inner city kids. And then the funding should be used to stabilize families. And finally, the third thing is funding should be used to increase employment. So, you know, if we reduce poverty, you know, riots will be a thing of the past in our inner cities.
When I look back at Revolution 67, and I've seen it a couple of times, the term outside agitators was used in the 1960s in those days to denigrate the protests in Newark and other cities. Now, in 2020, Jerome, the term seems to be turned around, and it was used even by progressive mayors to defend protesters and separate them from anyone who was involved in violent or criminal activity. It almost seems as if it's taken on a totally different meaning. I'd like your comments and insights, because one of the key issues in Revolution 67 is that it was blamed on outside agitators, and that seemed to be a pejorative. Now it's almost a defense of those who were protesting peacefully.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, in reference to outside agitators, you know, I haven't researched it to say that it's true, you know, that outside agitators fomented rioting in cities in response to the murder of George Floyd. I mean, if it was outside agitators, I would expect that the police would determine this when they made their arrests, and I would hope that they would make that information public. Now, the research we did for Revolution 67, I mean, yeah, outside agitators were also blamed for the 1967 riots, but we didn't find that allegation to be true. We found that the rioting came from within the community. And what we also learned is that the term outside agitator could be used, for example, by a mayor to deflect away from two issues. And those two issues are, number one, that his or her community is rioting out of the response of poverty conditions. And second, that it's the mayor's responsibility to get the community out of that poverty. But you see, if a mayor isn't interested in getting constituents out of poverty, what do? They blame the rioting on outside agitators, which is basically saying that the rioting is not coming from their community because their community is happy and has no issues that need to be dealt with. And so we see that blaming a riot on outside agitators could be simply a deflection tactic.
Whether it's outside agitators, whether it's anger, whether it is, as one person in a soundbite on John Oliver's show last week tonight said, that the social contract has been broken, can looting and violence ever be justified in a protest?
No, absolutely not. Looting and violence can never be justified in a protest. Looting and violence are criminal behavior. And even more importantly, maybe, is that this behavior then distracts from what needs to be done in our inner cities.
One of the things I wanted to ask Mary Lou is about a podcast we did last week. I realized that you're filmmakers, but you're also, as documentary filmmakers, you're journalists. Last week, we did a show, and we got a lot of positive reaction to it, called Journalism is Not a Crime. I took it from a hashtag that was on Twitter and interviewed the president of the Society of Professional Journalists. How do you think the media has covered the protests and related issues? Because my main focus last week was on attacks on journalists by police officers in some cities. But what about the coverage itself? Do you feel that it has been responsible and provides perspective?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we spend so much time cross-checking different media reports just for our own media. But the first thing is that the media is so vital. It's our access to real-time information. And, you know, of course, you know, we have to process what's reported and determine what's truthful, and that takes work. But I have to say that when we're reading anything, whether it's about this tragic murder of George Floyd or the protests, all of this, you know, reporting to have some resonance for us, you know, we expect, as Jerome says, and it's our message, that it should focus, yes, of course, on police brutality and racism, but it also has to talk about the underlying problem. So we're always coming back to the poverty issue and to solutions, because if we don't, then it's just this sensationalized, you know, let's look at people doing these acts and get everyone's attention without understanding it. And as far as, you know, these attacks on journalists by police, well, you know, this is simple. I mean, you know, everyone, peaceful journalists and protesters, you know, they have to be allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights. You know, that's first and foremost. You know, our police, you know, I don't want to vilify the police either, because we did 10 years ago in 2010, we showed Revolution 67 to 200 New Jersey State Police. And when we hosted a Cops Day at the museum for Newark police, you know, to have dialogue. And I heard many, many things about, you know, they're protecting themselves. They're not trained in many cases to deal with what's happening around them or to process it. So, yes, they should defend the public and themselves, you know, obviously, against danger. But if you have journalists and protesters, you know, peaceful and doing their job, in this case, then obviously there can't be any police action.
The whole theme of this episode is the fact that here was a documentary that was about 1967. And now, more than a half century later, we're in a situation where we're reliving not only the same events, but the same underlying issues. Are you concerned, either of you, that this is going to be swept away again? It's going to go away. People are going to say, well, that's done. Remember those disturbances in 2020 during the COVID crisis. And it just goes down underground yet again. Or is this the time that things really are going to change? Was this so widespread, so pervasive, with a very diverse group of protesters, that this is what is going to be the tipping point?
Well, I certainly favor the latter and would hope in my heart that that is the case. I mean, that's what we're striving for. We found that when we went out, and we do this actively to talk to people in diverse communities and not always preaching to the choir, it wasn't easy to have people talk about or feel that they had to do anything about poverty in inner cities. But after COVID, I mean, with, you know, vast unemployment, job insecurity, you know, all of these issues plaguing people, all of us around the world, I mean, we started to see that people were more responsive. And now you have these events. But we do have a presidential election looming. And that's why we're working really, really hard to get, and we do have a commitment for Rust, the third film in this trilogy, to be on national PBS in mid-October. I mean, we really need people to take action in how they vote and selecting their leaders locally and nationally. And all of this has to come down to legislation an active participation. But I read something interesting that was inspired by James Baldwin the other day that said it has to come from the person too, like at the very base level, you know. So how do you, and that's something we talk about extensively in Rust, is how do you eradicate racism? And, you know, a large part of that has to do with increasing the economics of the people who are oppressed.
I remember a line, well, the song is constantly played anyway, even though it's from the 80s, so I'm not really remembering, but in Bruce Hornsby's That's Just the Way It Is, and a law don't change another's mind when all it sees at the hiring time is the line on the color bar. In other words, you can have legislation and you can have political change, but it has to be hearts and minds. And I guess that's really the key of what we can do as individuals is a self-examination.
That's what the Baldwin quote was saying. You have to have, you know, political and, you know, change and all that systemic. But if it doesn't come, as you just described, Bob, that's exactly it.
Well, you're kind of asking, you know, to wipe out racism. And, you know, racism is a very abstract problem to solve, but poverty is not abstract. Poverty is concrete, and it can be solved with concrete measures. And if we can reduce the poverty in inner cities, that will take us a long way forward.
I want to ask you again, you were on the show in December when this podcast was first launched. That's going pretty far back, actually. I can't believe that I'm about, 6 or 7 months into this already. But tell us a little bit about the trilogy and about Rust, which you made reference to, Mary Lou, that it is going to appear on PBS later on this year.
Yes. So the trilogy is the three R's. Each title begins with the letter R. And we do want it to be a primer, you know, on inner cities. And if each film focuses on our home city of Newark. So Revolution 67 that we talked about extensively in this podcast. The second film is The Rule, which shines a beam of light on hope in the inner city because it's the success of St. Benedict's Prep here in Newark and the great work that they continue to do. In educating inner city young men, and soon young women are joining in a co-institutional, which has been, always been the question, which is wonderful. Will they accept young women? And they are. And the third film, Rust, is really looking, again, at to be hopeful, to look at as a beacon of hope for people to have tangible solutions to getting out of inner city poverty. And that's really the important thing. Not only do we look at education and urban school reform, but now what about adults? You know, what about people who are struggling? And now that definition of who is struggling has really expanded with COVID. Yes, unfortunately, it's going to take a heavy toll, and as it is already in inner cities, but it's also taking a toll on the rest of society.
And I'd love people to be able to get in touch with you and learn more about Buongiorno Pictures. So please give the website and any information where information can be obtained by anybody in the audience who wants to know more about the trilogy and all of your work.
Well, thank you. If they go to www.buongiornoproductions.com, and that's B-O-N-G-I-O-R-N-O, productions, plural.com, they'll find all of our films. And if there are educators in the audience, the trilogy, well, the first two films so far have free curricular guides for high schools, but they're used everywhere. They're used in elementary all the way up to graduate schools, medical schools, and law schools. So we absolutely want to make that available as companion pieces to the films. And we thank you, Bob, who you've always been there for us from the beginning. When we did the initial interview at that time with Dr. Price.
That's right. That goes back to a show that I still actually do, a broadcast show for the New Jersey Council for the Humanities called Humanities Connection. It's been on hiatus because of all of the production issues. This, of course, is right out of my house. So this was built for COVID without me knowing it last year. I had no idea.
Of you. Yes, that's great. And I don't know if you find this, but we were talking about this today with several filmmakers and others. I mean, this, this virtual, video conferencing or what we're doing has really helped us get connected in ways that we didn't expect.
I'm going to hold on to a lot of it, especially the video conferencing. A regular phone call right now, obviously this is audio, it's a podcast, but a regular phone call to my son or my grandson, it doesn't do the trick anymore for me. So it was always there, not always, but the past few years, the technology was there. So there's a few things I'd like to hold on to. My wife and I said we're going to cook at home more, but I want to see how long that lasts. That's going to be about a week. So we'll see how that goes. Yes. Jerome, thank you for being on here along with Mary Lou. Thank you very much. Any final words that you would like to say? I'll give each of you a little valedictory here.
Thank you for talking about racism and poverty, because, you know, you don't get rid of that stuff. We're going to have these problems over and over and over.
Yes, and we don't want to divert from the real situation. So you can't have sustainable cities with high poverty rates. When we reduce poverty, everything else, schools, crime, police relations, they will get better. And that's a quote from something we said 10 years ago at the COPS Day. And I pulled it out because I don't want to be saying it 10 years from now.
That's a great way to end. I love that quote. I thank you both for being on here. I look forward to seeing Rust, and I'm glad that you have a lesson that resonates in some of the most troubled times. Thank you so much for being on the program on Hot Media with Bob Mann, Mary Lou, and Jerome Bongiorno. That's it for this episode of Hot Media with Bob Mann. This podcast series is a production of Bob Mann Media, LLC, which is solely responsible for its content. The music has been composed and performed by Chris Mann Nelson. Technical help comes from Mike Phillips and Don Hoffman. The artwork and the website have been designed by Andra Design Studio. Please join us every week as we discuss the hottest controversies and hottest new content in mass media. This is Bob Mann reminding you that when it comes to the media, consider the source.